Chapbiz number 10, 3rd of December 2012, Business Banking.
Sponsored by the Stackyard Nursery, where you can have your gardens and interiors designed by Karen. Or just come and pick up a tree. We deliver too. Stackyard Nursery address is www.stackyard-nursery.co.uk. Or come and see us in Old Station Road, Mendlesham, in Suffolk, IP14-5RS.
Hello and welcome to Chatbiz. Today I have with me Peter Martin. Now, Peter is the Regional Treasurer for East Anglia for the Federation of Small Businesses. He's actually our branch treasurer in the Suffolk branch. He's the Deputy National Councillor for East Anglia. He's also the Director of Federation of Small Businesses Members Services Limited. So for the Federation of Small Businesses, you do rather a lot of representation. And I would say that was enough for most people. But on top of that, you're a partner with Fowler de Pledge. You're a chartered accountant who works within a law firm. Not many people will have come across that. Can I ask, what does a chartered accountant do within a law firm?
It's really quite simple. The move was 4 years ago to actually have multidisciplinary practices. Some people will have seen it where a dentist and a doctor get together, and so therefore you have a certain grouping of professional bodies. Well, the same goes in the legal fraternity. And this means that if people have financial issues, they may well also have legal issues, and vice versa. So by actually coming together, it means we can actually do a one-stop shop on those kind of professional services. In the country, there are about 10,000 law firms. Only 300 of them have chosen to go down the multidisciplinary route. So we're still quite rare, and it gives us quite a niche in the marketplace. But our clients find it really helpful. And as a chartered accountant, it means that I've actually helped this practice grow to double its size in the last 3 years, not only in terms of partners, but also in the kind of clients that we have, so that when people are looking to reorganise, I can do the structuring, while one of my partners will do the legal work for it. If they've then got a legal issue, or one of my partners is a tribunal chairman, one of our associates is a deputy district judge, and it means the pool of knowledge that we have is rather good, and it means we can give practical advice on the spot, on the day, without actually having to charge for other people to come in and give advice third hand.
So do you only do commercial work?
We do mainly commercial work. We do a little bit of private conveyancing and on the wills and probate side, but they tend to be things that we do for customers we already have. We focus on actually employment law, in my case, forensic accounting. So if there's an issue that's happened within a business, I can investigate what's happened and find out a solution, a way of getting the money back frequently. Or in the case of a divorce, that's frequently what's known as hide the asset.
Mm. Yes.
In which case, actually, so long as you don't do too many of those, because they're very draining, your clients are very emotional and it's an emotional time, it is hugely satisfactory, a lot of satisfaction to me in particular, when you find something. When you have to spend a day in front of a judge explaining it, you also have to be on your toes and make sure that everything you say you can prove.
Yeah. Now, this experience you've brought to the Federation in quite a big way. You lead, under the banner of East Anglia, the banking reform. Now, for anybody out there who has got a business and has had any dealings whatsoever with banks, you will know that your business manager can sometimes tell you one thing, and when the paperwork comes in, it's not quite as it is. And when you go back to challenge him, he's gone. Somebody else has taken over, and they say, oh, no, we haven't done that. Or they deny things, or they say, oh, well, you misunderstood. Now, one of the big things that you're leading at the moment is you are actually challenging the banks with regards to interest rate swap agreements.
Right, an interest rate swap agreement is where the banks say interest rates might go up. If you take out this insurance policy, If they go up, you won't have to pay any more. The problem that has come with these is a bit like the mis-selling of the PPI that people will be aware of on their own credit card, is that they forgot to mention that if interest rates go down, in fact, there's a huge charge. Now, in some cases, because when this was being pushed was just before when interest rates were pushed down to 0.5%. Interest rates go down when there's a recession.
And we're in a big recession.
Absolutely. Now, because the interest rates have gone down in this recession, it also means there's pressure on the other parts of the business. So where before they would have benefited by a lower interest rate to help offset the fact that sales were going down,
mm-hmm.
or some of their other costs were going up because of the recession, then they're no longer in that position. Some of these things that were sold to them were sold to them in, I can only describe as an underhanded way. And that is that if somebody is introduced to you by your bank manager as the expert in this kind of insurance product, then you rely on them. You trust them. They've come with a trusted person that you've dealt with for many years. Unfortunately, the banks are now saying that these salesmen weren't advisors, and it was up to you to make your own judgment. This is not fair, it's not equitable, especially as some of these people, and from what we've seen so far, some 40,000 people the banks have acknowledged being missold, they were given no choice. It became a requirement of the loan. Now, if you're going to borrow a large amount of money, you might want to cover that risk, and that's perfectly reasonable. However, having not been told what the options were, for example, you could have gone somewhere else, you could have not taken the risk at all. Alternatively, you could have, for a very small fee, had what's known as a cap-only policy.
Mm.
This means you pay a fee. If it goes up, you're covered. If it goes down, you reap the benefit. So you've minimised your risk all round. A typical fee on a three-year loan would have been about £30,000, depending on how much was borrowed, but say £1 million. For the person who's taken a three-year loan when interest rates went down, they will have paid now £150,000 in excess charges back to the bank.
Good grief.
Now, what small business can wear a cost of £150,000 when their sales are going down because of a recession? What they're doing effectively is putting business on the back foot. And a number of them have then been told that in order to help them, they need to go into intensive care or some other euphemism for the bank to help them. And for that, there's an additional monthly charge. Their interest rates may well be put up because the bank's got to recognise the risk.
Now, Peter, to me, and I am an ex-banker, I was on the domestic side, I wasn't on the business side, and this is exactly the same as what was pushed through to the domestic side with regards to if you took a loan for £10,000 over 5 years, your monthly repayments would be £250. But we highly recommend that you take the protection. Your interest rate, your payment back will be £425. And I understood that. I also understood the benefit of that to certain people. And if you stayed within the parameters of that protection, I could see the point for some people. I will say most of the loans that I probably didn't do with it, and hence the fact I'm not in banking anymore. But there is a correct point. Do you think that the banks thought this was the only way to go, or do you think they were honestly underhand?
I think that they saw it as another way to make money. And it's as cold and as simple as that.
Right. So what happens to anybody who's out there who is sitting with this, and I'm going to use an abbreviation here, IRSAs and interest rate swap agreements? What can they do about it?
Well, they've got to act, and they've got to act quite quickly. There's two reasons for that. The first part is that the Financial Services Authority, after considerable lobbying of organisations such as ours to Treasury and to them, have agreed that in principle a small business having bought one of these was missold.
Why?
There is, however, a 9-month hiatus while the Financial Services Authority have allowed the banks to review the cases themselves. Now, we're naturally sceptical about.
Yeah, so if your bank manager comes back to you and says, oh, by the way, you have to sign another piece of paperwork or whatever, it's a case of...
No way, Jose.
Buyer beware, right.
That's the first part. The second part is that a lot of these were taken out, as we say, just before the interest rates slumped back down to 0.5%. This was between sort of 5 and 7 years ago. There's a thing called the statute of limitations of 6 years. This means that if people don't act within 6 years...
They're going to run out of time.
They can run out of time, statute barred, and therefore they are unable to claim by law. It's most important, therefore, that they put in process, one, a claim against the bank, and two, even if this 9-month review period is going through, not to rely on the banks, because if at the end of it they say they're not going to pay out, or if they're timed out during the 9 months, the bank can walk away. So they will have to take protective measures. Now, within our region, we're currently seeking to find if there's a way of grouping these kind of claims so that minimises the cost to our members. But equally, you can go to your solicitor, firm like ours or any other competent commercial organisation, and actually make a claim against the bank. It will mean, first of all, vetting that you actually have a claim, because you don't want to enter litigation without a good case.
Yes, that could be expensive for nothing.
And frequently we find that people have had verbal conversations with their bank manager, and therefore it's about evidence. The fact that you're small, you don't have more than 50 staff, you don't have millions of pounds worth of assets, can be to your advantage. But it's evidence that counts.
So, verbal contract. So if I make a contract with somebody and I say to them that, you know, I do something, you know, I have a tree nursery, I do garden design, I do interior design. So I make a contract with people at the very beginning, and we have amendments to that, which goes all the way through, because somebody will say, oh, can you just add on? Can you just take away? But when it actually comes to a legal position, verbal contract is taken into account. But you're saying that it may not be in this case without the paperwork to back it up?
I'm saying it's about quality of evidence.
Right.
Okay, and the quality of evidence is that if you've got a verbal agreement between one person and another, it's good so long as people acknowledge it or they've acted on it and they've performed it over many years, and so therefore there's evidence to say that there must have been an agreement, although it wasn't written down, because people have performed it.
So anybody listening to this who doesn't have a full paper trail, don't give up.
The answer is don't give up, but find the additional slots. So, for example, if you look at correspondence that was entered into before having one of these agreements, it will lead up and tell, and people will see what it was they were thinking, and a judge will view that. The other part, though, is that if it's then a written contract afterwards, the written contract will normally supersede the verbal unless a mistake has been made. Mistakes happen. However, to overcome a mistake, you need to prove that it was a mistake. So that prior evidence, the prior writing, the prior notes of a meeting that was had, or the witnesses that were there that heard it said, become very important. So witness statements are important, notes of what happened at the time. But frequently, and a very good thing to do in everyday life, is if you do agree something verbally, send them a letter or an email just to confirm it. Because if you do, and then you act on it later on, they can't turn around and say, oh, I never agreed that, because you've confirmed it back to them in writing, they've acted on it, you've acted on it, and you've got a far better set of evidence.
Oh, well, I think that's a great tip, a great hint for anybody at the present moment who's going to go forward with any lending. But for anybody who's in this position, let me summarise that they should either contact their solicitor, a forensic accountant like yourselves who are part of a solicitor's practice, and you would recommend that rather than approaching the bank themselves.
I think you need to have advice first, and the reason I say that is because the trial of the review of the internal reviewers of the banks has come out, and amongst those were what I will describe as biased questions. The biased questions are, for example, at what point did you decide, from the various options that were given to you, for you to take out one of these swap agreements? Now that presumes...
You had a choice.
The one, you had a choice. Two, that you were given options. So therefore it's an unfair question. And that's the kind of question you answer at your peril unless you do so properly advised.
And there are other organisations out there who are fighting quite strongly in this field, and one of them is Bully Banks. So if anybody wants to have some extra information, the Financial Services Association website has the information. Her Majesty's Treasury has information, and Bully Banks do, and Federation of Small Businesses. Go along to your local branch meeting and meet the team who would be willing to help you, and they will put you in the right direction. I think that's quite major. And one of the things that is concerning a lot of small businesses at the moment is lending, is access to finance, reasonable access to finance. Now, in the East Anglian today, which is, sorry, yesterday, which is Thursday, November the 29th, the leader of the Santander in the region, Corporate and Commercial Banking, said that the government's funding for lending initiative has helped to increase lending to small and medium firms in the Anglia region by 10% over the last year. From the people I speak to, there's not many people are actually getting help with finance being either an extension on the overdraft, a short-term loan, repositioning the lending as it is now, or mortgaging. Now, the Chancellor launched a scheme to boost small business lending on the 19th of March this year, 2012, where he said that he would put money forward, £50 million would be put forward, and, sorry, £20 billion would be put forward, and guarantees for unsecured borrowings. Now, that sounds great. But from the research I've done, the amount of people who are saying that that money is not forthcoming, is that what you're finding?
That's absolutely not forthcoming. And the key here is the word unsecured borrowings.
Mm.
There used to be a scheme called the Small Firms Loan Guarantee Scheme, where people paid a 2 or 2.5% premium to the government, and they guaranteed the majority of the money back to the bank should the you default on that loan. Now, that was then reasonably well taken up, but some of the banks didn't like it because they still couldn't get a personal guarantee from you. Let's face it, you were paying the government to guarantee it. And so long as only 1 in 40 defaulted, the premium that was paid over and above actually meant it was self-funding.
Mm.
If less than that fund didn't default, then it meant quite simply the government made a profit, or otherwise they took a risk. But in return for that risk, it meant that there was funds going into businesses that meant that there was opportunity for growth, for employment, for high street shops to have the ability to earn, to therefore pay rates, provide community services, and the money spins around. That was replaced 2 years ago with another scheme, but it allowed the banks to charge against your house or get other personal security from you. That scheme was a dismal failure because hardly anybody took it up because there was no advantage. Why pay a premium if you've also got to put your house on the line?
Yeah.
And some of the banks would say, well, if you're not prepared to take the risk, why should they? There's a degree of logic in that. However, the security that's being asked for is frequently disproportionate to the amounts lent. So I'll give you an example. A company which has a loan of £300,000 by way of overdraft, which as an accountant I would normally query, especially if that wasn't how much they had in sales every month, but nevertheless, they increased that loan by £100,000 three times, so it had gone from £100,000 to £200,000 to £300,000. These individuals were reasonably wealthy, and each time they wanted another £100,000, they asked for another property to be secured. So three properties were secured that had a value of about £1.2 million.
For £300,000?
For a £300,000 overdraft.
Hmm.
That's nuts. What it did mean was they had no ability to actually weather any storm outside the normal running of the business. And an overdraft is repayable on demand. In other words, the bank can ask for it back tomorrow.
Yes.
They couldn't sell any of their properties. They couldn't expand their business. And when they did actually have a bit of a problem in their business, it started to falter. Now, one of the things that I did was actually to remove that funding, put a proper structure in, so it could move forward. Well, why couldn't the banker have suggested that? And one of the problems we had 3 years ago was the desire by some of the banks to remove overdrafts completely and put people onto invoice discounting, factoring, etc. The problem with that is, why? The argument given was that because of a court case some years ago, their security wasn't as good on debtors as it used to be. The problem is that where before they were charging an annual fee for having an overdraft, it was based on what you borrowed. Factoring or invoice discounting, there are two fees, one for the cost of the funds you use, and one based on your total turnover. So their fees have just gone up. That's taking unfair advantage of the need to actually, for the bank to strengthen its position. It's strengthening it, all right, but at your cost.
Yes, detriment to the business.
And is it a cost you can afford? Mm. And some businesses have found they can't, and they've collapsed.
What about alternative funding to the High Street Bank? Now, I watched a programme on television, and I thought it was absolutely fantastic. And that was Dave's Bank, Bank on Dave. And Dave Fishwick, who is a businessman who supplies the largest amount of minibuses in the UK, did a programme. He set up the Burnley Savings and Loans Limited, and he opened the doors in September 2011. And the company was actually created by him and managed. And he came to the conclusion that the banks weren't loyal to the customers where the customers were loyal to the banks, and they were rather underhand. He's had a huge amount of trouble, as you know. The FSA have been watching him like a hawk. But he wanted to do it so that people got a return on their savings. And he was actually given 5%, which is huge in today's market. And this allowed him then to lend small time to individuals as well as small companies. So by offering actual affordable loans to people who struggled to actually get finance from the High Street, he has started up a small bank, a bit like the American system of the credit agencies.
The savings and loan.
Yes. And they were very, very good. I mean, there's quite a lot, as you know by my accent, I'm from the northeast of England. And actually, there's quite a lot of the credit agencies were set up by small housing estates where people put money in and the money was invested back in the community, etc. That isn't, apart from the fact that obviously the television programme's been done, that's not promoted, is it?
No, it's not. And I have to say that I saw that programme too. Absolutely brilliant.
Mm.
He's a character.
Yes.
He doesn't like rules. And saw in a business opportunity. Well, that's what business is about. That's a good entrepreneur.
Mm.
The other part was that he kept it local. He kept it local so that he could actually control it. When these things become huge, how do you control them? You end up by employing, for argument's sake, some American to come over and run your bank in the UK. He has no idea of the local concepts, the general philosophy of life, and is only interested in the return to them, not to you. Someone like this actually means you get the local service. It's like local building societies, many of whom have been absorbed of recent times, but the local building site, the philosophy of them is brilliant. The local credit unions are excellent because they lend small, and everybody knows.
Mm.
There's complete transparency. There's no transparency with the big banks. The other part on that is that with regard to other attempts at opening small banks of recent times, we had one that started in Essex. Unfortunately, that hasn't been a success. And there's recently been one started up in Cambridge for Cambridge and Counties. We're hopeful that it'll be a far bigger success because they've actually employed not only local business people, but some dedicated bankers, but with the aim to support business. They won't take risks. They're not going to go out there and do things which are foolish, and they have to be fully regulated. But what it does mean is that there is a growing number of options coming up. The trouble is, some of the alternatives are what we call cherry picking. They'll only go for where you've got security, and they still leave you in the hands of others. Our problem, as we see it, is for the others. They haven't got the security, and at the present time, interest rates gone down to 0.5% base rate, but where before they'd be charged, say, 5 or 6% as an interest on an overdraft, when base rate was 5%, they're being charged 10% now, or more.
Mm.
That means that the bank is actually making, instead of 50% profit on the use of funds, 1,000%. We've also seen these delightful loans on the TV, which have that small print, which is getting bigger, I think.
Yes.
1,700%, 3,000%, 4,000%. In the olden days, these were treated as being usury, illegal.
Mm.
And there needs to be more legislation to put a cap on these kind of things so that there's less opportunity for some of these lenders, be they large or small, to take advantage of people who are actually struggling.
Yes, I mean, looking for alternative funding is quite difficult for businesses. And the Global Finance Stability Board, FSB, has this month issued recommendations to prevent the repeat of the role of unregulated finance institutions played in the financial crisis that we've just all gone through and know of. And Eric Ainsley is a former chair of the Institute of Chartered Accountants, no doubt you know him, for England and Wales, and has warned of excessive intervention from regulators which further stifle the flow of funding to small companies that are already complained about access to bank financing. Now, I had never heard of shadow banking. And I will say, before we came on air, Peter was very good and explained it to me. There are different ways to gain access to it. Now, there is what one would call crowdfunding, alternatively named crowdfinancing, equity crowdfunding, or hyperfunding. They all sound very American for a start. But what is it? And should we, if we require money, go peer-to-peer?
It's one of these ones where if a business, when they normally start up, they start up with the use of their own money.
Yeah.
Then they look at friends and family. Then they might widen their net. And in widening their net, they may look for government grants or a local institution that has some kind of knowledge of what their industry is, and they're looking for money that way. They will have been to a bank, and the bank says, well, you've got no trading history, so therefore how can you repay it? That's a perfectly reasonable question. You then have what's known as private equity. Private equity comes in many guises. So, for example, you may go to a company which is fully regulated that has a pool of, say, 2,000 investors. They're educated. They understand it. They've been through it before. We've all seen Dragon's Den.
Yeah.
And they're of that ilk, although I'd like to think that they're not quite so keen on the percentage return for the investment. The key here is that there are people who can actually add skills as well as money. When we go to peer-to-peer lending, it's less organised. It relies on a vast number of people who all put a small amount in, and so therefore it's a risk they share. So if it goes down, they've lost a little bit of money, but they haven't lost everything. The danger is that in doing that, if it's not regulated in any form whatsoever, is you have the thing that we had in the last few years in the UK, which was called boiler room, which typically were call centres in Spain, where they would ring up vulnerable people in the UK, convince them that spending a small amount of money on an equity was a good idea, but there was no control over it. And sadly, a lot of the money didn't end up in the company that they were actually told about. Now, there's been a couple of high-profile cases where the people who were organising those have gone to jail. The trouble is that shows you what can go wrong when it's not regulated, or when people think they've got a sneaky way around the rules because they were calling from outside the country. We do have to have rules on investment. They do need to be relatively flexible, but we still have to have rules.
And this is where I think we have to, as business people, take on some diligence and due concern of our own as to where the money could possibly come from. And that is why traditionally we've always gone to the high street bank. What would you advise a startup business at the moment who are looking for some funding? Where would you recommend them starting?
I would actually start normally assuming that they haven't actually got something up and going already, is friends and family. There's two reasons for that. One is they already know you. And if they know you and trust you and like what you do and have seen things that you've innovated on before, then they're easier to convince. And but more importantly, because they have trust in you, if you throw it away, you're actually throwing away your friends, your family, and everybody else. So there's a responsibility both ways. I think that's good. Having proven it by getting it going, you're actually in a position to actually then go and get secured funding or lending from a normal institution or a small equity house, because you've actually proven it. It does have an opportunity. It will then come down to the risk and security that can be offered. But I would start with friends and family.
Lovely. Well, thank you so much, Peter, for joining us today. We will put some links on the website. And if anybody wants to contact you, we will have your email and links to your company. You also, through the Federation of Small Business, are having a banking forum on January the 11th next year, 2013. Is that open to anybody?
It's open to anybody. We will be having quite a number of the members of Parliament for Suffolk and Norfolk, along with at least five of the main trading banks represented. Last year we had 95 of the public, members of the public and members of the Federation of Small Business in attendance, and we would highly recommend that anyone who's got a particular interest in the banking sector, what has happened to them, and it can be good stories as well as bad. There are times when the bank does the right thing. It isn't just about hitting them over the head with a brickbat, but we do want to encourage them to have more of those, because all too often we hear of the sad stories.
Yes.
And this is an opportunity for the banks to follow up from last year. There are certain commitments that they made to demonstrate what they've actually achieved, and equally to help the members of Parliament. And last year we had a permanent undersecretary from the Treasury there as well, to actually take back real people's concerns to Treasury, the government's treasury, to actually encourage the banks to do the right thing. It's a slow process. However, if you all get involved, the banks will see what's actually required, and then they can deliver it.
That's great. We'll put a link on the website. Thanks, Peter.
Bye.
And now for the news. Suffolk Photographic Competition. The Suffolk branch of the Federation of Small Businesses and ChatBiz are running a photographic competition to show the beauty of Suffolk and promote the use of social media by small businesses to communicate with each other and their customers. All small business people in Suffolk and their customers are invited to contribute a photograph showing the beauty of Suffolk, along with a description of why, for them, that place has a special magic. Only one entry is allowed per person. All entries must be the work of the entrant, and by entry to the competition, the entrant gives the right to the FSB and ChatBiz to republish the photographs and texts and provide it to third parties to use for promotional purposes. The competition will run from the 1st of January 2013 until the 1st of April 2013, and submissions should be made by emailing the photograph to simon@chatbiz.org, giving the location and saying who took the photograph and why it is a special place. All submitted photographs can be seen by clicking on the links to the Picasa website or Google Plus, where you can vote for the ones you like best. The current photographs on these sites are for test purposes only. Procurement pipelines. Cabinet Office Minister Frances Maude published procurement pipelines on November 28th, detailing government's business opportunities worth up to $84 billion. Having championed the prompt payment code in the same week, Maude promised an increase in the transparency and that the pipeline updates for the 18 different sectors would be published every 6 months from now on. It makes commercial sense to nurture our relationships with suppliers by discussing what business is coming up, he said. Procurement report. Local authorities are finding procurement rules a major obstacle to effective procurement, according to a survey in the November edition of the Local Government Lawyer. Local government has faced and continues to deal with budget cuts, yet rising costs, in particular with adult care, and increased pressure from the Community Secretary, Eric Pickles, to deliver economic growth via the Localism Act 2011 and the Public Services Social Values Act 2012 continues. Some 44% of the more than 100 respondents to take part said the procurement rules were a serious obstacle to implementing such structures, while a further 40% agreed with the statement that the rules were a slight obstacle to implementing such structures, but one that could be relatively easily overcome. Of the rest, 8% said the rules made no difference either way, 6% suggested that they were slight help, and just 2% described them as a great help. Key findings from the survey in these areas include 1 in 5 respondents, 19%, said that their organisation rarely or never engaged with suppliers in pre-procurement to discuss how their requirements may be met. Almost half the respondents, 48%, had not reviewed their tender procedures in the light of the government's policy on improving access for small and medium enterprises.